Today we begin week number 20 of our 4.5 year journey through all of God's inspired word. We are still in the books of Moses. In fact, we've just arrived in the book of Exodus. So you can open your Bible to Exodus chapter 4. And we're going to begin at verse number 27 today. The story so far is this. Moses has spent 40 years in personal exile in the country of Midian. Midian is to the east of the Gulf of Aqaba. And he is there because he killed an Egyptian taskmaster that had been abusing an Israeli. And when the Pharaoh found out about it, and the Pharaoh that I believe we're talking about here is Hatshepsut, she wanted him dead. So he escaped to a place where Egypt did not have any real control. And so he's been there taking care of sheep for 40 years. Now he's moved on with his life. He's remarried because he was apparently originally married while in Egypt. But now, after many years in Midian, he ends up marrying the daughter of the priest of Midian. And he's working for his father-in-law, taking care of his flocks. And while he was taking care of those flocks at a place that we will eventually call Mount Sinai, but was called Horeb, or the dry place, God appears to him in the burning bush and tells him he wants him to go to Egypt and get the Israelis out. Moses tried to object, tried to make up reasons why he shouldn't be the one, until finally God tells him, "You're the one. You're going." So Moses left Midian, taking his wife and his two sons with him. And on the way, God insists that the newest boy is circumcised. Now, we suspect, and I say we, I mean myself and others who have studied this, that he had circumcised the firstborn, and that this caused great maternal distress. Mom was upset, and she was not going to let this happen again. And so this second son had not been circumcised until God meets Moses at this lodging place on the road from Midian to Egypt, and Moses is gravely ill until finally Zipporah, the wife, gives in, circumcises the boy herself, throws the foreskin at Moses' feet, calling him a bridegroom of blood, and then she takes the boys and storms off back to Midian. And so we will not see her again until her dad brings her and the boys to Mount Sinai to repair the relationship. All right, so Moses, therefore, is on the way. He's on the road from Midian to Egypt, which would have taken him, I believe, past what I suspect is Mount Sinai, and past the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. And coming from the opposite direction is his brother, whom God has spoken to supernaturally and told him to head this direction to meet up with Moses. And so that's where we pick the story up. Exodus chapter 4, verse 27. He who is, and remember that's the divine name, the pronunciation as best we can tell is probably Yahweh, which was the ancient verbal form that meant he is. It hardly ever gets used because the structure of Hebrew typically includes that in the verb. He is this, he is that, he is the other thing. So this is the actual verb form of to be, but it's in a third person masculine form, he is. So that's why I keep using that as the divine name. So he who is said to Aaron, and this is Moses' brother, older by about 3 years, go into the wilderness to meet Moshe. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And so this gets back again to a little bit of our geography. We know Midian is on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is a branch of the Red Sea. That puts it in modern-day Saudi Arabia. At this time, one of the largest cities in Midian was probably a place that is now called Tabuk. And there is a mountain that is the highest mountain in Jordan, and it's just across the border into Jordan from Saudi Arabia. This mountain is called Yamul Ad-Dami. And on the north side of it, there is this great big flat area that is part of a wadi system that I believe makes it the perfect spot to act as Mount Sinai. Now, as far as I know, nobody else suggests this spot, but I find it intriguing. And here's another one of the reasons why I think so. It is southeast of the top of the Gulf of Aqaba, about 30 miles, which means it is smack dab between Tabuk and the top of the Gulf of Aqaba, which means it would be along the path going from a major city of Midian toward Egypt. And so as we've seen here in the text, it is somewhere on a road from Egypt to Midian near the mountain of God or Horeb or Sinai that Aaron and Moses meet. And I think that is God's organization and appointment schedule, but also so that we can better identify the potential location of Mount Sinai. Verse number 28. Moses told Aaron all the words of he who is with which he had sent him to speak and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Now, this is important because Moses feels that he cannot speak well. It's not that he's uneducated. It's not that he can't think his way through the formulation of sentences and things. It appears to be something to do with his actual speech pattern. It's possible he had a stammer. It is possible that he may have had a super, super high squeaky voice, or maybe he had a super, super low gravelly voice. But there was something about his speaking that made Moses uncomfortable. And that was one of the things that he said to God as to why he couldn't serve as God's spokesperson. And God's response was, well, I know that Aaron can speak well, so he is going to be your spokesperson. You will tell him everything that I tell you, and then he will pass that on. And so that's what we see happening already. Moses brings Aaron up to speed about everything that God has told him up to this point. Verse 29. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. So now they've arrived back in the land of Goshen, which seems to be the easternmost branch of the Nile as it passes through the delta. And that means that they have traveled, Moses for sure, somewhere over 250 road miles by this time. So it's taken them quite a few days, a couple of weeks to probably make this trip. And then they call the leadership, as God had instructed them, of the tribes. Verse number 30, Aaron spoke all the words that he who is had spoken to Moses and did all the signs in the sight of the people. So what were the signs? He was going to throw down the rod of power, Moses' shepherding staff, made of almond wood, and it was going to turn into a cobra. And then Moses was going to grab it back up again, and it would turn back into the staff. So apparently they did that. The second sign, because we see signs plural here, is that if the leadership wouldn't believe, Moses was then going to have them all put their hands inside of their clothing. And when they withdraw them, they would have zero melanin, no coloring in their hands. This is called leprosy. It is a mark of God that was typically put on persons, places, and things to indicate something was not right, something needed to change, something needed to be evaluated. So God had done this to Moses and then fixed it by having him put his hand back into his coat. And so Moses apparently does that with the people, using Aaron as the spokesperson. And no doubt they were all relieved to get their hands back to their normal color. A third sign that was to be used, which we don't know, was that if they still didn't believe, he was to take a container of water from the Nile and pour it out on the ground, and in that act it would turn to blood or turn blood red. So he does these signs, Aaron doing all the talking, and verse 31 says, the people believed, and when they heard that he who is had visited the people of Israel and that he'd seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. So the people seemed to be happy to hear that the God of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, or Yisrael, their namesake as a people, was now back in their lives again, that he was going to get them out of this mess of slavery and take them back to the promised land, which they probably had been told over and over again for many generations. Within about 400 years of us coming as a people to Israel, God's going to take us to Egypt. God is going to take us back to Canaan. All we have to do is wait. And so that's become a sort of legend or a story that they tell around campfires, no doubt. And now it's come true. And they are at least initially excited about the potential here. Chapter 5. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, which means now they have to head upstream to the kind of the wrist of the delta, the place where the different streams spread into the delta region out of one singular bed. And there near this monstrous oasis is probably the headquarters of this particular pharaoh. Now, who do I believe this is? I believe it is Thutmose III. He was a baby whenever his father died, and his stepmother, Hatshepsut, exercised control. Not just simply as regent, she thought of herself as pharaoh, and she's even represented in some iconography, some of the paintings and carvings as pharaoh. She even has the little fake beard and the special headdress. So she runs things until her death, which apparently happened shortly after Moses escaped. And then Thutmose III takes control of everything. He will be followed on the throne of Egypt by a son that is not his firstborn. Now, isn't that interesting? Because that would fit the story that this pharaoh's firstborn son dies during the Passover event. So I am relatively confident that Thutmose III is the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And he is unacquainted personally with Moses. Remember, he was a young child when Moses left for Midian. But no doubt he has some sort of intelligence about the family of Moses, because Moses had been the adopted son of a daughter of a previous pharaoh. So their family would have moved up in the status of Egyptian society. They would have still been thought of as Semites, and therefore pure-blood Egyptians would not have liked them all that much, but they would have had privileges better than the enslaved families. So the pharaoh is probably acquainted with this specialized Israeli family. And now he meets for the first time a guy he's heard about, Moshe, the hero of the Cushite invasion. That comes from Jewish tradition. Had happened in an earlier period. So here comes Moses and Aaron. They ask for and obtain a personal interview with Pharaoh. That's one of the other reasons why we can be pretty sure that Pharaoh is aware of this family. And this is what Moses, through Aaron, says. Thus says, and I'm going to use the actual pronunciation here, and here's my reasoning for it. Because Moses and Aaron both speak Egyptian fluently. Moses grew up speaking it, and Aaron, because he's part of Moses' family group, also would have grown up speaking it fluently. So they are speaking Egyptian to the Egyptian pharaoh. And so they throw in a Hebrew verb that means he who is, but sounds like Yahweh. And when they do this in the context, it's clearly the name of a god that Moses and Aaron are aware of, that Pharaoh is not. And so that's going to come into his response. So, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. So, the first thing that God requests, or actually demands of Pharaoh, is, I want you to let my people go to have a festival of worship in the wilderness. Now, the wilderness would be to the east of the delta, along the highway that goes out of Egypt toward the rest of the Middle East. Pharaoh's response, verse 2, who is this Yahweh that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I don't know Yahweh. Moreover, I will not let Israel go. So his response is, who in the world are you talking about? I know lots and lots of gods and goddesses, but I've never heard of this Yahweh God. Verse 3, then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to he who is our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence and with the sword. So the first appeal is you need to let the Hebrews do some worship and ceremony to their God, whether you know him or not, because you know how it is with gods. If you don't do what they tell you to, they will often punish you. So they're trying to appeal to the Pharaoh's own religious attitudes. If your God tells you to do something, you do it. So our God has said that he wants us to go 3 days' journey eastward from Goshen, That would take them over into the Sinai Peninsula along the Royal Highway that goes up eventually into the area near Canaan, and there offer sacrifices appropriate to their God. The Pharaoh is still not impressed. Verse 4, the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens. So I don't want any more of this talk of my slave force going on a holiday for a couple of weeks. I need them back to work. Verse 5, Pharaoh said, behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens. So you are causing trouble. You are disrupting the workforce. And we've got an awful lot of Israelis. We'll find out later in the numbering system that there's about 600,000 adults, possibly we're talking about specifically men there, but we've got 600,000 as a core number, which means that a workforce that we're talking about here is probably a few million that are working for the pureblood Egyptians. So verse 6, the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, you shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past, you shall impose on them, and you shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. And therefore they cry, let us go and offer sacrifice to our God. Let heavier work be laid on the men that they may labor at it, and pay no regard to lying words. So the Pharaoh figures, you know what? I know what'll cure this. I will increase their workload as a penalty. And so he demands that they now get their own stubble, their own straw, if you will, the reinforcement material that would be put inside the mud, which they would then form into clay bricks, which was the common construction material. And so these guys that we're looking at particularly here are Israeli clay tile or clay brick makers. Probably several hundred thousand of them that are probably engaged in this sort of activity, not just simply in the Delta, but probably up and down the Nile, because there's going to be building projects for the Pharaoh up and down the Nile. So now they're going to have to get that themselves. So the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out, said to the people, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go, get your straw wherever you can find it, but your work shall not be reduced in the least. So the people were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. And the taskmasters were urgent, saying, complete your work, your daily task each day, as when there was straw. And the foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmaster had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why didn't you have you not done all of your task of making bricks today and yesterday as in the past? So they've got a quota. The Egyptians were big on keeping records and keeping numbers and setting standards. So they've got a daily quota of how many bricks they have to produce to be used in construction. They're not making that quota because some of their workforce is now trying to get all of the straw that used to be provided for them. So they get in trouble over it, and they're like, why? Verse 15, the foreman of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, why do you treat your servants like this? So this is the top guy in the brick making industry for Pharaoh. So he gets an appointment to go and talk to Pharaoh himself and says, Sir, why are we being mistreated like this? Verse 16, no straw is given to your servants, and yet they say to us, make bricks. Behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people. So this guy is making a false assumption that Pharaoh is not aware that this is happening. He thinks this is the middle men, the middle management people that have changed the rules. And so he figures, if I just let Pharaoh know about it, he will fix it and get everything back to the way it was. Verse 17, but he said, no, you are idle. You are idle. That's why you say, let us go and sacrifice to Yahweh. Now, go and work. No straw will be given you, but you must still deliver the same number of bricks. The foreman of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble when they said, you shall by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily task each day. So when the Pharaoh says, no, I'm the one that ordered it. And the problem is, you guys are begging to leave your job for a couple of weeks and go out and worship this Yahweh character that I know nothing about. So you guys are just lazy louts. You're just trying to take advantage of us all, and I'm not going to put up with that. And so now this guy knows that the reason the workload is increased, the reason some of them are being beaten, is because Moses and Aaron made the request for them to go. Verse 20, they met Moses and Aaron who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh. And they said to them, may he who is look on you and judge, because you've made a stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants and have put a sword in their hands to kill us. And then Moses turned to he who is and said, oh, you who are, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? And so now things are worse than they were when Moses first arrived. And his response is, why, God? Why are things worse now? Why are you doing this? And unfortunately, we'll have to stop the story there. I'll see you tomorrow when we get back into the Word.